Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history.
What you're about to listen to is a recording that Brant and I did for his school lessons as he's teaching white kids in America. The original purpose of it was to discuss my video about RENAMO and Rhodesia and the killing of the million blacks. And Brant had very specific, insightful questions that he wanted to ask. So the purpose was really to discuss Rhodesia-related stuff. But as we were talking, he got sidetracked and I got sidetracked. And some of the sidetracking was of great importance. And we ended up with various insights that he had and insights that I had. And I wanted to focus on those insights. And then we also talked a lot about liberalism. How were the whites of Rhodesia after the blacks came to power? How did they feel about things? What did they participate in? So I tell him other things, and we have quite a discussion about liberalism as well, and about America and what went wrong in America, and why didn't America help Rhodesia? There are a lot of things in this discussion as we go in all sorts of directions. So we chat about South Africa and much, much more, and also how things link together and how things may be linking together that we'd not really thought about before. So it was a very interesting discussion with many issues, including all kinds of South African Rhodesian stuff that was thrown into this. But I expressed the viewpoint that when I look at liberalism, I see liberalism as just another Jewish scam. It's just another bunch of Jewish crap that has been pumped into whites, but it doesn't actually have any long-term value, and that whites will break out of it. The key being, how long can the Jews keep the scam going? The scam has got a limited lifespan. Here in Africa, that lifespan was maybe 20 to 30 years. I can't see it lasting too much longer than that, even in South Africa. In America and Europe, the Jews might be able to keep the scam going for longer, but the scam is a scam, and whites start popping out of it. What really helps whites to pop out of it is all the work that we are doing in the white right. By constantly pumping out information, other whites start waking up. So I want to show you two videos of whites in America who woke up. And my general feeling is that if everyone works at it, that you will be surprised and astounded with time how many whites are able to pop out of this Jewish liberal bullshit. That this bullshit can be seen through, and as time goes by, it'll start to fall apart more and more. As people start asking more questions, seeing more things, and realizing that there's something very screwed up here. And that it's really just a matter of getting whites out of this stupidity that has been thrust on them through insane amounts of Jewish media that has spread this propaganda in every conceivable way. The first little video is from a young lady on Gab. From my records, this was spread on Gab. And she did this short video, and she said that she's going to create a series called The Dumb Bitch Shit I Said as a Liberal. and I liked this little video, but I never could find a follow-up for this video. I would have loved to see the series that she put together, because here she describes how stupid she was, and then she realized the truth. And now she feels that she was such a fucking idiot. And this is what is going to happen to everybody who was a liberal. Because race is real, and what all the racists have said for over 100 years is totally and utterly correct. Hitler was right. All the racists were right. But Jews have come with a storyline that sounds like it's logical, but it's not logical. And the whole thing is going to fall apart eventually. In the discussion I have with Brandt, we discuss also how the liberal Rhodesians who stayed behind and lived under the blacks, how did that work out for them? And that thing also fell apart. But Brandt had a special insight that I totally agree with about the danger that white liberals pose to whites. And so we discussed that too. But anyway, the first video is dumb bitch things I said as a liberal. And then the next one is Scott Adams, the creator of the cartoon Dilbert. Now, Scott Adams was very pro-black in the past, and then in recent times he woke up, and now he also talks about race and about blacks, and he even says that people must stay the hell away from black people. But what is interesting is to listen to these whites, these genuine whites, and how they came out of liberalism. And Scott Adams tells you why he was a liberal, how he believed that blacks were the winning side. You'll see my definition of a liberal when I talk to Brandt, because I have a specific definition of a liberal. Anyway, Scott Adams even talks about this Rasmussen poll, is it okay to be white? And he points out it's almost lunacy to even see that such a question is actually asked in a serious poll. That's how crazy America is. That's how crazy Jews have made America. Now, a very interesting thing is that Scott Adams says that he thought that by helping blacks, it could have a big effect. But in reality, by going down that path, while liberals may think that's a cool path, I want to tell you that that is a losing path. That white people misdirect their energy far too much on helping other fools, other races, and other idiots. Whites should really be focusing all their energy on white society. Leave these other goofballs alone. But it's good to hear his reasoning, because you can then see where he's gone wrong. These things give us insights into how we can approach whites who are still being fooled. I'm a big believer that we should try and bring as many whites back, if I can call it that way. I think that given time, that we can get the vast majority of whites back on the same side. I don't think that the Jewish scam can last forever. But it's going to be a fight all the way, because Jews protect their lies, and Jews will invent new lies and new variations on old lies in order to keep the scams going. Something you must keep in mind about a guy like Scott Adams, who's so high profile and known all around the world. I myself used to read the Dilbert cartoons, and I actually liked the Dilbert cartoons myself, and I'm very pleased to see that someone who's as high profile as him has come out in public. But you need to be aware that a guy like him, who's very high profile, that Jews and liberals are waiting for him to say the slightest thing so that they can haul him into a court. So he's got to play doubly and trebly careful with what he says. I'm sure that he could be even more direct, except he's got to watch out that he doesn't end up in court. So he's doing the best he can, given his high profile and his vulnerability, because there are lots of Jews and liberals waiting to climb down his throat if he says something that can be used, even in the vaguest way, in a court. But at least he comes out and says, you know what? Stay away from black people because it can't be fixed. That is a very deep insight for a guy like him to turn around and say that it can't be fixed. That's very important. That's what we whites in Africa have known all along. When he talks about the blacks focusing on education, I think he's also just doing that in order to be careful legally of how he treads. Because if he turns around and says, yes, but they're low IQ, there's nothing you can do, I think he's got to be real wary of that. So he's saying what he can say. And he points out that he's done all these other things to help them, and that everybody else can look after themselves. And he's tired of speculating about why blacks can't look after themselves. And he's tired of that, and he's also tired of seeing them beat up non-blacks. He's really inferring whites again. So he's saying his thing very carefully, but he's getting a message across, and it's absolutely excellent. So here's a guy who spent a lot of his time, a lot of his money and energy to help blacks, and he realized that they are ingrates, they are ungrateful for what has been done, that most of them hate you anyway, and that all the kindness was totally wasted. And in that sense, Scott Adams has learned a lot of what the Boers have known for hundreds of years, and what whites who came to Africa in more modern times also learned. That these people are a waste of time, and you can't fix them. And of course, the other thing is, even if you could fix them, should you fix them? Because remember what I've raised about Nietzsche and will to power. And nature is about power. And if you take someone else and you make them strong, they can turn on you. Do you really want to give blacks power? Do you really want to give Jews power? The correct answer, according to nature, is no. That's very stupid. So anyway, I think Scott Adams has done a great service by turning back to his own. And I think that many, many whites can still be turned around. There are some who are hardcore sacks of shit. You'll get your Bidens and Clintons, and that kind of scum here and there. My own view is that if you find hardcore whites who absolutely have a hatred for whites, maybe one needs to deal with that as treason. And that's that. But anyway, here is the little video from the girl who said that she spoke all that dumb liberal shit. Then the video from Scott Adams, and then we enter the show where Brant and I are talking, and we talk about a lot of stuff.
If you don't vaccinate your children, you deserve to have them taken away. No, I don't believe that any longer, but it goes for the series Dumb Bitch Things I Said as a Liberal. I was so brainwashed into thinking that vaccines were 100% safe and effective, and that unvaccinated people were a danger to myself and my children, that I honestly said shit like that to people online less than 10 years ago. So yeah, I apologize for that one, because that was some real ignorant shit. It wasn't until I made friends with somebody whose child had been vaccine injured that she took the time and showed me her resources and documentaries and things from actual doctors who go against the standard CDC protocol. So yeah, I still feel bad about that. So stay tuned for more of dumb bitch shit I said as a liberal, because there's a lot. There will be no shortage.
Well, Rasmussen poll had a provocative little poll today. They said, do you agree or disagree with the statement, it's okay to be white? That was an actual question. Rasmussen asked, you know, white and black voters, and probably others, do you disagree or agree with the statement, it's okay to be white? 26% of blacks said no. It's not okay to be white. 21% weren't sure. Add them together, that is 47% of black respondents were not willing to say it's okay to be white. That's like a real poll. This just happened. Did you have any idea? would you have imagined that could have happened? So I realized, as you know, I've been identifying as black for a while, years now, because I like to be on the winning team. And I like to help. And I always thought, well, if you help the black community, that's sort of the biggest lever. You know, you can find the biggest benefit. So I thought, well, that's the hardest thing and the biggest benefit. So I'd like to focus a lot of my life resources in helping black Americans. So much so that I started identifying as black to just be on the team I was helping. But it turns out that nearly half of that team doesn't think I'm okay to be white, which is, of course, why I identified as black, because so I could be on the winning team for a while. But I have to say, this is the first political poll that ever changed my activities. I don't know that that's ever happened before. You know, normally you see a poll, you just look at it, you go, whatever. You know, oh, this is interesting what other people think. But as of today, I'm going to re-identify as white because I don't want to be a member of a hate group. I'd accidentally joined a hate group. So if you know, nearly half of all blacks are not okay with white people, according to this poll, not according to me, according to this poll, that's a hate group. That's a hate group. And I don't want to have anything to do with them. And I would say, you know, based on the current way things are going, the best advice I would give to white people is to get the hell away from black people. Just get the fuck away. Wherever you have to go, just get away. Because there's no fixing this. This can't be fixed. All right, this can't be fixed. You just have to escape. So that's what I did. I went to a neighborhood where, you know, I have a very low black population. Because unfortunately, there's a high correlation between the density. And this is according to Don Lemon, by the way. So here I'm just quoting Don Lemon when he notes that when he lived in a mostly black neighborhood, there were a bunch of problems that he didn't see in white neighborhoods. So even Don Lemon sees a big difference in your own quality of living based on where you live and who's there. So I think it makes no sense whatsoever as a white citizen of America to try to help black citizens anymore. It doesn't make sense. It's no longer a rational impulse. And so I'm going to I'm going to back off from being helpful to Black America because it doesn't seem like it pays off. Like, I've been doing it all my life, and I've been, the only outcome is I get called a racist. That's the only outcome. It makes no sense to help Black Americans if you're white. It's over. Don't even think it's worth trying. Totally not trying. Now, we should be friendly. Like, I'm not saying start a war or, you know, do anything bad. Nothing like that. I'm just saying get away. Just get away. And here's my take on all of it. Everybody who focuses their priority on education does well. If anybody in the Black community focuses on education, they'll do well as well, because the system allows that. If they don't, I can't make that my problem anymore. It just can't be my problem. It can't be my problem if the solution is so clear, so available, and people don't want to take it. It's just not my problem anymore. So I resign. I resign from the hate group called Black Americans. According to the Rasmussen poll, 46% of them don't think white people are okay, just being white. And there we go. You didn't expect that today, did you? But the most helpful thing I can do is to say I'm not going to help. Do you understand that? Continuing to help in that sort of, you know, classic, oh, let me help you, give you a, you know, a lift up, give you a hand, you know, mentor you, hire you, prefer you. I'm going to stop all of that. I'm done with all of that. Yeah, no, it didn't work. The only thing that will work is to say, you got to fix your own problem. You know how to do it. Everybody else figured it out. I'm not going to speculate, you know, why you're not doing it. I'm not going to speculate why there's a difference. I'm just going to say it's available to everybody. Just pick it up. It's free money. Focus on education, and you could have a good life too. But those who don't want to focus on education, you just need to get away from them. Just get as much distance as you can. That's my recommendation. And I'm also really sick of seeing video after video of Black Americans beating up non-Black citizens. You know, I realize it's anecdotal, and it, you know, doesn't give me a full picture of what's happening. But every damn day, I look on social media, and there's some Black person beating the shit out of some white person. I'm kind of over it. I'm over it. Right? So I quit. And it feels good not to be in a racist hate group anymore. So I'm now independent. Not a member of any group. I do not align with any group. Not the white supremacists and not the Black racists.
In this episode, we're going to be looking at the Civil War, which was set off in Mozambique, the country just east of Rhodesia. And this time period will be covering approximately 1974 to 1994. How are you doing, Jan?
I'm doing fine, thanks, Brent.
All right, thank you for being here.
It's awesome to be talking to you again.
All right. So as we pick up this time, Rhodesia is still under white control. It's after UDI. And Portugal used to control both Angola and Mozambique. And what we're talking about here is after the Portuguese had been kicked out of Mozambique. Is that correct?
Correct.
They left.
Correct.
It. Okay.
The Portuguese, just to quickly give you some background, the reason the Portuguese disappear is because inside Portugal, there are the Portuguese government is run by a guy called Salazar, who's a fascist. He's actually an excellent leader. Later, I will discuss more about Salazar. He's actually a fantastic leader.
And the Portuguese government is determined to not let its empire go away. They are the only European country that totally and utterly rejects the notion of decolonization. Interestingly enough for you is that there may be a parallel between what the Portuguese did and what the French did in Algeria. So that's one to just keep in the back of your mind, because there are quite a number of parallels there. I may touch on these things later. So France at one point didn't want to give up Algeria in the north of Africa, in the same way that the Portuguese also decided they're not quitting any of their empire, even some of their empire that was sitting in India. They weren't going to give up any of it. But what happened is, in the war, the Portuguese were taking a lot of strain. And eventually, it led to lots of internal problems inside Portugal, because people did not like being called up to come and fight in all these wars all over the show. For them, it was like Vietnam was for the Americans. Why are they fighting in this faraway place? And they don't really understand it, and they feel miserable about it. Life is very hard, etc. But they don't see the bigger picture, which I will be discussing in videos that I'm going to put out. So eventually what happens is there's a coup d'etat, and all of a sudden some lower ranking officers seize control of Portugal. They toss out the government. And when they do that, they actually decide they're just going to give away the whole freaking empire, get rid of the whole damn thing. And so that is what causes the whole thing to turn on its head, is this coup d'etat. The proper name for it is the Coronation Revolution. And the Portuguese are just too happy. No more war. That's it. Let's toss it away. But it's one of those cases where whites give up when in fact there are higher issues at work, which we will discuss another time. But they basically give away Angola, Mozambique, and their other places, and they actually are fighting three wars in Africa. But the other one is in a small country that's far away, and it's not one that I really bother mentioning, and I don't think there were many whites there. Whereas the Portuguese had quite a big white population in Angola and Mozambique. So it's this Coronation Revolution, and then they stop the war, hand over everything to the blacks, and total disaster for the whites of Southern Africa.
Yeah, I can see why that would be a total disaster. Okay, I think that there is also a correlation between the fighting that the Rhodesians were doing to maintain the integrity of their country and fight against the terrorists. And while they were doing that, that fight was being alleviated a little bit because Portugal was controlling Angola, and more importantly, Portugal was controlling Mozambique, which was the eastern border of Rhodesia. So the Rhodesians didn't have to worry as much about the border with Mozambique because Portugal had that under control until the Portuguese government collapsed in the coup d'etat, and then the Portuguese citizens had to get out of Angola, had to get out of Mozambique, and now there were many other borders that the Rhodesians had to defend against after that Portuguese coup. Is that correct?
Yes, that is exactly correct, because the eastern border, it's almost from directly north of Rhodesia all the way around the east, even down to a little bit of the curve in the south. Suddenly there's this, I think it was 1,000-kilometer border that's suddenly open. You know, previously, even when the Portuguese couldn't control their territory fully exactly, it was still a tremendous help. You know, the Portuguese probably buffered the blacks by like 90%. And so it was like a huge amount. The Portuguese were basically a buffer state for us. And so we didn't have to do much. But now when they're gone, and now the blacks have taken over, not only has Frelimo taken over, who are an enemy, but Zanla, which used to be in Zanla and Zipra, who were in Zambia, Zanla actually moves into Mozambique to function exclusively from Mozambique. Now they've got huge territory where they can build bases, hide their stuff, and the government there is willing to support them with their army. So all of a sudden, the whole thing becomes a military nightmare. There does seem to have been maybe a bit of a... It's interesting that there was some kind of perception in Rhodesia that something was going to happen. And I'll tell you the one thing that is important is that we... Our only link to a port was through Rhodesia, through the east, to Mozambique, to Beira. And Beira was the closest port, which was a Portuguese port. And also to Lourenço Marques, which is further south. Do you know that Rhodesia did not have a direct railway link to South Africa?
And I didn't know that.
Yes, Rhodesia did not have a direct link to South Africa. And I'd need to go and double check, but Rhodesia started building a railway link to South Africa sometime before this. And I think, I'm talking from memory, if I need to check up on it, I can. But as best I can remember, they started building it, and I think that they said it was going to take 2 years to build this railway line, because it was like a 600 kilometer railway line that they had to build. Because all the other railway lines, there's like another railway line to South Africa, but it goes through Botswana. And so that's a black state. So they wanted a direct link to South Africa. And I think that the project was supposed to take 2 years, but they actually finished it 6 months or so ahead of schedule because it was that important. They put a lot of effort into it. I think that they finished it just a while before Portugal collapsed. I'd need to double check some of the finer detail, but that was a very strategic move because it allowed Rhodesia to have rail traffic directly to South Africa. So there may have been some kind of foreknowledge of something being dodgy. There's something more to this than meets the eye, but it's a very important strategic move, and the Rhodesians did do it. And when the Portuguese collapsed, the Rhodesians was absolutely fine. It's not like we suddenly found ourselves unable to do railways and things. Something like that.
Okay, that makes sense. And for younger viewers that may not understand the importance of that, if you're able to transport things on rail by a train, you can transport thousands of times of material that you could if you were using tractor trailer trucks on highways. And you're also saving expenses because the trains, you know, excluding the engine at the front, it's just cargo. You're moving so much stuff. So it probably doesn't take any longer if you're moving between South Africa and Rhodesia than if you were on a highway, but you're moving a tremendous amount of material back and forth. So that's a really good idea if you're transporting a lot of stuff across land.
That's actually a very brilliant thing to say. And I just want to add to that. People forget the importance of rail. Rail is actually one of the most underappreciated European inventions of all time. That to this day, there is no method of moving heavy goods across land as efficiently as rail. And in South Africa, the blacks ignored railways, and they let the railways collapse to a large degree. And now we've got trucks, large numbers of trucks in South Africa that destroy the roads. They destroy the roads because trucks wear the roads out. So you're completely correct in everything you've said. And I also recall reading that the American railway system maybe the most efficient railway system in the world. And people don't even realize it. There's something about the design of the American railway system that allows the American rail system to move goods at the cheapest rate of anything in the world. People forget the absolute genius of the importance of railways.
Yeah, they are important. And I've lived in a few towns that has a major rail coming through, you know, going east to west. And so you're very aware of the routes and the timing. And if anyone's ever been to a port city like in Seattle, you can see them, you can see things getting loaded or unloaded off of these tankers. And some of them get put on tractor-trailer trucks, but a lot of the stuff, those actual containers, they get picked up and then they just get put directly onto a train and boom, and then they take off going east to west across the country. And they're carrying millions and millions of pounds of material at a time. So yeah, it's very efficient. But, you know, in South Africa, it's too bad when you have the wrong people taking over your country that didn't build the stuff. They're not necessarily going to maintain it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. It's actually fascinating how much emphasis the whites in Rhodesia and South Africa put on rail. In South Africa, railways was a completely white invented thing and run, and it ran, boy. It moved, you know, South Africa is much bigger than Rhodesia. South Africa moved vast quantities of stuff by African terms.
Yep, that's important. So one of these days, hopefully South Africa can get its rail system rebuilt. So the next question that I have, I don't know how relevant it is exactly to what we're talking about right here. I don't know if you want to take a stab at this or cover this in a different episode, but I was wondering if you think that whites should have done something different in the defense of Rhodesia, or was losing control of the country a foregone conclusion because of the physical fighting, the invasions, sanctions, pressure from the West, etc. Is that a question that you'd want to answer now, or is that something that we want to answer in different episodes?
No, I can definitely take a stab at this. Okay. When I look at Rhodesia and the whites, and I look at all of us whites in Southern Africa, the way that whites behaved in all of Southern Africa, whether it was Rhodesians, South Africans, or even the Portuguese, is that whites were very much in what I'd call the shopping mall kind of a mode, capitalist mode. The way that whites face these problems, you must understand that these issues of blacks, etc., coming at us and sanctions and all these things, none of this stuff was seen decades ahead of the time. We could see that the blacks are becoming uppity and the blacks are doing various things, but the whites were on a good roll, and the whites were actually getting stronger in Southern Africa after World War II. After World War II, believe it or not, there were lots of British people who after World War II, after they had beaten the quotes evil Nazis, okay, they actually were sick of Britain. Britain, living in Britain was a bunch of shit. And there were lots of whites from Britain who moved to Africa. Most of them came to South Africa. And because Rhodesia was pickier, when Rhodesia took in whites, they had lots of requirements for those whites. Rhodesia was not a society that could afford whites coming in there who are going to do nothing. Rhodesia was not a place for people who want to live off the dole. Rhodesians had to be productive. People who come into Rhodesia had to be productive from day one. They had to have some kind of value. So the population of the whites were increasing after World War II. There was quite a flood of whites who came to Southern Africa. Plus, by the way, even Italians who were prisoners of war, who'd been taken into South Africa to come and do prisoner of war duty, like building bridges and things. The Italians built some beautiful bridges here in South Africa. And you know what? After the war was over, there were many of them who decided to stay. So we had quite a lot of people. We had quite a lot of whites who came to Southern Africa immediately after World War II, including Brits. And so everything was rocking. Our economies were moving. My own parents left South Africa to move to Rhodesia in 1948, 3 years after the end of World War II. They reckon, no, stuff South Africa, we're going to go to Rhodesia. Things are rocking in Rhodesia. So those first 15 years after World War II, from 1945 to 1960, things were rocking and rolling and going from strength to strength. Lots of things were happening. And in some of my videos, I'll put out more details of the things that were happening. So whites were coming in, and whites were rocking, okay? And whites were feeling confident and everything. The thing that pulled the plug on us, the actual pulling of the plug, occurred when the British Prime Minister Macmillan came to the South African Parliament and gave the Wind of Change speech. Because Macmillan came here, and in the South African Parliament, he said that Britain is going to dump Africa. That's basically what it boiled down to. So until 1960, everything was rocking. When the British said that they were going to dump Africa, they were also indicating to the whites of South Africa and all whites in Africa that the whites are basically on their own. That Britain's leaving, and what happens to the whites is they're not going to do anything about it. Why they did it and all that kind of stuff, we're not going to discuss here. But they came to that conclusion, and they decided to pull the plug. And Britain controlled about a third, very roughly a third of Africa, from all the many colonies they had. And so they decided that they're just going to give everything to the blacks. And that is where, as they were doing that, that's where the local whites who were living in Africa, the Rhodesians and the South Africans, they were looking at this and they were saying, what? Is this going to be our future? So it caught the whites off guard. And then as the British were quickly, because the British were quick, they were quickly just finding any old black who wants to rule, hey, even if he's a commie, even if he's a murderer, you know what? We think he won that election. Here's the country. Cheers. You know, handshake, cheers. We'll keep in touch. See you at the Commonwealth meetings. You know, all is good, you know. And the British were just pulling out. So that gave whites a shock, gave them a tremendous shock within the first year or two. After 1960, the whites were going into a state of shock. And the leaders started actually saying, what the fuck are we going to do? So by about 1962, the leaders of Rhodesia and South Africa, some of them moved faster than others. The Rhodesians were starting around about 1962. The Rhodesians were starting to think, we need to go it alone. And that's when there is a bunch of diplomacy that happened between the Rhodesians, the South Africans, and the Portuguese, which we'll discuss in other episodes. But anyway, so what I'm saying is the whites were caught off guard. The whites were caught off guard, and the reality of what they were going to face only started really dawning on them in the early 1960s. And by 1965, they put their foot down, and they had done, let's call it their preliminary work and diplomacy and thinking, and they decided in 1965, we're gonna dig our heels into the ground, we're gonna rebel against Britain, and we are not going to accept black rule. So that is what, you know, from then onwards, the gloves were off, whites are not gonna hand over to blacks, that's that. So it's only from that time that the whites are now starting to see, you know, what can be done. There were whites who were very afraid, by the way. There were whites who were very liberal, who were afraid that if they rebelled against Britain, that the country was going to collapse. So there were even whites who fled out of Rhodesia prior to UDI. Prior to UDI, they were like, oh God, you know, we're going to rebel against Britain. We can't live here. We've got to get out. So you had a state of panic. And then the others were saying, no, we're going to hang in there. All right. So it was basically the white strategy was resist and also wait and see what is thrown at us. And mostly the whites were winning easily in the early years. When the Russians and the Chinese sent in the first terrorists, the whites were clobbering them quickly, and it was easy to win. And the first 8 years or so, and from 65 to 72, was pretty easy going. In 72, the blacks made a big attempt to attack again, and it took them about a year and a half to smash that lot and to again, you know, come back and all is good. So the whites were fine until the collapse of the Portuguese, because then also the Russians and the Chinese and the blacks were now really keen to get stuck into us. So the whites, what I'm trying to describe is that the whites were similar to all modern whites. They were similar in that they lived in peace and they were used to law and order. And they really saw these political things and these moves by the blacks. They saw this as a nuisance and they saw it as we need to have peace so that we can carry on doing our work and making money. And they had that kind of viewpoint of life. But by rebelling against Britain and working as a state, they have to realize that, you know, when you are fighting other people, this thing can go very wrong as well. And despite their natural, they were pretty determined to fight back. But I don't think that they had the kind of confidence in themselves that you will find in America or Europe, etc., where you've got a country that's lasted a long time, it's lasted for hundreds of years, it's fought many wars, it's won some, it's lost some, but the people have learned to stick together. In the case of Rhodesia, it's a small group of whites, they're trying to make a stand, and they are conscious of their small numbers and their weaknesses. And they aren't quite sure how to fully function as a group. They want to fight, but they don't have like a long-term view of history where they could say things like, you know what, we've been attacked by the world before and we survived and we did this and this and this. And you know what, we can do it again kind of thing. They didn't have that. Mm-hmm. They were much more dodgy in that, you know what, maybe we should just run, or when the blacks win, that's it, you know, we'll never be able to come back. So they didn't have like a long-term kind of view that they could lose and that they might even survive after they've lost and that they might even want to be able to try again, something like that. They didn't have that long-term thing. They just focused on controlling Rhodesia. And there were even some of them, like Ian Smith, who saw Rhodesia as like all or nothing. And that whatever happens to Rhodesia, they will have to live with it. And if Rhodesia goes under black rule, they will stay there under the blacks. They didn't think in terms of, you know what, we are whites. And why don't we talk to the South Africans? South Africa is huge. The South Africans are wealthy. You know, why don't we talk to the South Africans and say to them, okay, if we lose, can we have like a state strategy for, you know, we move our stuff into South Africa and and we operate from South African soil. They didn't think in those kinds of terms. I actually did another video that wasn't that popular. I did it about a year ago. I don't know if you ever saw it. It was quite a complicated video, but I looked into the issue of what other options were there for Rhodesians other than just handing over to the blacks? What if the black political solution was unacceptable to whites? The whites did not seem to have any kind of planning that went beyond a political solution. At the end of the day, America and Britain and everybody said, but you've got to talk to the blacks. But nobody ever actually asked the question, what if we don't decide to talk to the blacks? What if we find the whole thing totally unacceptable? Can we survive anyway? There's only one guy in all of Rhodesia who actually suggested another alternative. He was a guy called P.K. van der Byl. I don't know if I've discussed P.K. van der Byl with you in the past, if that's a name that means anything to you.
I recognize that from one of your previous videos.
Okay, let me tell you a bit about P.K. van der Byl. P.K. van der Byl was a South African from the Cape who actually came from a wealthy family. He was actually quite a wealthy guy. His family was wealthy here in South Africa, and he moved to Rhodesia. And he's actually quite a fascinating bloke. And this South African, he's quite a fascinating character. One day I want to talk quite a lot more about P.K. van der Byl, because in Rhodesia, he was the highest ranking South African in Rhodesian politics. And at the time of Ian Smith. And P.K. van der Byl was the Minister of Defense of Rhodesia. And as the Minister of Defense, he was a very popular man. We liked him a lot. The English liked him. Everyone liked him. He was a very popular guy. The guys in the army liked him. And he was a little bit... he wasn't quite like a hardcore military guy, but he had a mindset that I think was racial. I think that of all the higher ranking Rhodesians, he may have been the most racial of the lot. In fact, do you know that he later married an Austrian princess?
I did not know that.
No, he was this wealthy single bachelor, and later he married an Austrian princess, and it was quite a nice thing in Rhodesia. Everyone was quite proud of it. And anyway, P.K. van der Byl is the only high-ranking leader that I know of who actually at some point proposed that we should engage in a fighting retreat. And I saw that the other Rhodesians all dismissed this idea. They said, oh no, P.K. van der Byl came up with this stupid idea of a fighting retreat. We're going to fight our way out of Rhodesia and retreat to South Africa. And I actually think that, you know what? That was a clever idea, and I really liked that, and so much so that about a year or so ago, I actually did quite a detailed video, including maps, where I looked at the possibilities of whether strategically it made some sense if instead of trying to retain control of all of Rhodesia, if we actually started doing like other whites and Europeans in bigger countries, if we actually started abandoning parts of Rhodesia. So I based it on what's that king? Frederick the Great. Frederick the Great was a good military king. And Frederick the Great has a quote where he says, If you defend everything, you defend nothing. If you defend everything, you defend nothing. And I see that as one of the strategic weaknesses of all the whites of Southern Africa. Rhodesia was guilty of it. South Africa was guilty of it. The Portuguese were guilty of it. Whites had this obsession with all or nothing. We either defend the country and control everything, and if there's the slightest thing happening anywhere, then we start getting panicky. And people get panicky just because the blacks have seized a chunk of territory in a certain place, and then everyone starts panicking and people want to start jumping on planes. But in actual fact, if we had a tougher European, German, Roman kind of a mindset, we could have said to people, hold on, you know, just leave us to take care of this militarily in a proper way, you know, and maybe some of you must move out of there and we'll relocate you somewhere else. But there was this thing where if people felt that we were losing in the slightest way, that whites would very quickly start jumping on planes and getting out. Our morale was very fickle. And it's also true for South Africa, even now. And our morale was very fickle. And we didn't have the kind of Roman mindset of, you know what, we're going to fight until we win, even if it takes us 30 years. You know, we didn't have that kind of mindset. So I think that militarily, we had more options. We had many more options, but we were always thinking in terms of politics, and the British and Americans and everybody else was saying, no, you got to do this with politics. Politics is going to solve it. And I must tell you, I walk away looking at politics as the solution as a bad solution. The military solution can deliver much better results. And I think that if we'd had a better teamwork of sticking together, that we say, you know what, we're not going to run away, we are going to stand our ground, and if some of us have to take losses, then that's the way it has to be, but we will work as a team all the way, and we will never give in to these blacks. And if we need to, we will retreat to South Africa in bits and pieces. Because if we retreated southwards slowly over a period of time, that was very doable, actually. I did a whole video about it. I even tried to estimate how many years we could have done that. Because South Africa was our supply line. We got a railway line to South Africa. We got roads to South Africa. And the South Africans can send us weapons and ammo and stuff. We could have, you know, we could have functioned as a group and actually have retained things. And the stuff that we couldn't keep, we could have done what everybody else does. Blow it up, set it on fire. You know, if you lose control of something, blow the freaking thing up, burn it down so the enemy doesn't get it. And I must tell you that I am convinced for all of us in Southern Africa that if we had approached things where we rather use the military option, because the military option is based on reality, whereas politics can be a lot of bullshit. And the blacks say, oh, no, we don't agree to that. You know, and then what do? Now you listen to Jews and liberals and they say to you, no, but you must negotiate. Well, the blacks will tell you, no, we want everything. And so what do you do when you got a political situation that you can never really resolve, and where you are at loggerheads and they disagree on their value of what they think they can get, and you disagree about the value you want to give? So when I look at it, I must tell you, I think that if we had let military be our primary way of viewing things, we could have done a lot of things differently. And I must tell you, I think that even for the Portuguese and the South Africans, that that is true. That but all of us were too fickle, and everybody saw the war and the blacks as a nuisance. Oh, this nuisance must come to an end so we can carry on living like we used to live. Instead of saying, hey, you know, you've got enemies. The enemy is going to be there for a long time, and we need to also face them for a long time. And that, you know, we mustn't just give stuff away. And I really think, I'm absolutely convinced that a total military approach, if we'd acted, for example, like Hitler or Napoleon had acted, or Frederick the Great had acted, or the Romans had acted, if we'd acted like those guys and focused on the military thing, even when the Germans were losing and the Germans were retreating, they'd retreat, they'd blow stuff up, they'd retreat, they'd form another defensive line, they'd fight there, etc. I must tell you, that is the correct way to do it. That's the correct way. Military trumps politics. The more I look at all of our politics, especially even your politics in America, but I must tell you, in Africa, even more so, I see politics as a scam. I see it as total bullshit. And you're dealing with these blacks. These blacks are like, no, we want everything. We want everything. Give us everything. We're not willing to accept anything else. No, I think politics is bullshit mostly. Rather let military stuff take precedence and stick together as a team. Because among the other things for the Rhodesians is that even if we'd retreated out of Rhodesia, and even if we'd lost all our properties, if you look at what happened over the next 25 years after Rhodesia collapsed, you'll see that the vast majority of the whites, what happened to everybody? Everybody ended up losing, okay? Mm-hmm. Later, the farmers lost their farms, and the farmers had to flee after 20 years. So, you know, if we'd all had a viewpoint of, you know what? When we lose as a team. And we all take our losses and we still help each other and we still work together as a team. If we'd had a bigger team viewpoint, we could have retreated, we could have taken our losses, but we could have ended up, for example, maybe retreating out of most of Rhodesia, maybe not even all of Rhodesia. We could have retreated, and even if we had left all of Rhodesia, we could have still ended up in South Africa with a lot of our possessions and, more importantly, the vast majority of our weapons. And we could have functioned from South Africa. South Africa's big. And we could easily have negotiated with the South Africans and said to them, hey, you know, can we live in this territory and we'll have Rhodesian settlements in South Africa? And we will protect this part of the border. And, you know, let's carry on and we'll still attack the blacks and fight them. You know, I must tell you, when I look back on it, I said to myself, why the hell didn't we think like that? But I think that we were just not in that mindset. And we looked on the blacks. We just weren't ready for it. Too much of letting economics and business be the focus of your people, when in fact the state and the military is much more important, much more important. So those are my thoughts.
Those are just your brief thoughts on the subject. But there's you said so much there. I could go into detail on any of that stuff. I just want to hit a couple of things. When you're talking about having more of a team mindset, I see this across the West with all of our people, because we've been so good at producing the Industrial Revolution and mass processing and of goods and mass processing of food and delivery of food and technology with the running water and the heated water and the electricity and, you know, building structures quickly and roads, infrastructure, rails, etc., that our people have been accustomed to an easier, softer life where there's less stress, where what you try and do in life is you're trying to make more money than someone else, or you're trying to go on as many vacations as you can. You're trying to take as much time off. You're trying to relax. You're trying to watch TV, sports ball, Netflix, eat a lot of, you know, fast food, drink your beer, you know, whatever is pleasuring, you know, just grab as much pleasure as you can possibly get in your life, because we're not fighting to stay alive. We don't have that savage instinct. We don't have that fighting instinct that we used to have. So I'm not talking about all the other nuances that you brought up there, but I am talking about that ability to draw upon that savage instinct that our people used to have and had to have, which has been almost bred out of us now. And like you said, they weren't ready for it. They weren't ready for what happened to them. They weren't ready for the UK government to come down, be extremely anti-white, and just drop the bomb on them and say, look, we're just going to leave you to this mess. We're pulling the carpet out from underneath you. You spent, let's say, was it around 75 years, somewhere in that time period, that Rhodesia had been moving into existence and had existed. We're going to yank the carpet out. Everything that you built, you've got to turn it over to the blacks now who didn't build it, and they're going to be in charge of you. Good luck. Bye-bye, everyone. So I know I said a few different things there, but we have to get back in touch with that natural savagery that we do have inside of us genetically, because that's part of being human. That's part of who we are. And we need to be able to rein that in and to utilize it and focus it. And another thing that I think is happening there is that the Rhodesians, because they had only been in existence for a short amount of time, they didn't actually see themselves as what I like to call Western kind. Like, they are the same people as in South Africa, and they're the same people as in the United States, and they're the same people as all across of Europe, and they're the same people that's in New Zealand and Australia. We're one people. And that's this huge, giant history that is unparalleled with any other race that we can all draw upon regardless of where we are in our lives. So they should have that Spartan mindset. They should have the German mindset. They should have the Roman mindset, because that's who they are. That's who we all are.
You said a lot of very interesting things, if I may jump in there quickly. When I look at America and Europe and Britain, I see people with lots of focus on social things, partying, going to the beach, and like you say, all the fun stuff that you do. And people are partying and enjoying holidays and where they're going. And the thing that they take for granted, a thing that all modern whites take totally for granted, is the state. The state is your umbrella. The state is the thing that controls your entire environment. The state, the government, the police, the army, they are the ones that provide the umbrella for you and that enable you to live in peace and in safety. And if the state goes, you will find yourself in hell. And whites don't give enough value to the state. Of modern leaders, I think Adolf Hitler is a particular guy we can point to as a man who understood the value of the state and the role of the state and what the state should be doing for the good of everybody. And that is something which in the Anglo type of world, you'll even find Jews. I remember there was that Jew in Canada, Molyneux, I think his name was, where he actually did something a couple of years ago where he was saying, the state is going to disappear. I think there's more than one Jew that said that. Oh, in the future, the state's going to disappear, and we're all just going to carry on living, and it's all going to be great. Well, let me tell you something. When your state disappears, it will be conquered by the people who don't give up their state. And I'll give you like a little example. If If white Americans were to say, you know what, screw the state, okay, screw the feds, screw the state governments, etc., we're gonna take the army and the National Guard, and we're gonna just quit. You know, we're just gonna give up on them. We're gonna dismantle them, because we're just gonna live happily here. We don't need the cops. We don't need the army. We don't need the CIA. We don't need any of that. Well, let me tell you that your neighboring state, Mexico, could then come and conquer you, probably. Maybe not exactly in your terms, because you people still have lots of guns. But if you people totally disarmed yourself, if you totally disarmed your state and yourself, then the Mexicans could come and conquer you. And people don't appreciate government. And I think what has also happened is that government itself has become so low quality, all the best minds are constantly, or most, 90% of the best minds are looking for positions in science, they're looking for positions in business where they can make money, and people are not moving the best minds into government, into the army, into the police, always. And our value system has been, government, it's just that nuisance thing. But the time when you're going to realize the value of government is when you lose it. And for us in Southern Africa, I can tell you that all of us whites who are here, we yearn for the fact that we've lost all our state powers.
Good point. We can't even fathom that in most of our countries, because our states haven't been completely turned over to anti-whites at this point in time. It is a process. It's definitely happening in the countries of the British Isles. It's definitely happening in the United States. I think for a lot of us, it snuck up on us too, because we weren't aware of what was going on. Because if your state is rotting from the inside out and it's doing it on purpose, they're not going to tell you about it. And the media is not going to tell you about it. You have to learn the hard way. And fortunately, since we have the internet now, we can share this information, and we can look back through decades of time, and we can see how things are getting worse and worse, how things are being subverted. I think what you're talking about there, for the Rhodesians and the South Africans, the state was there to support you. It was there to support the citizens. Okay. Specifically, I might say that it was there to support the whites, because it was built by the whites. And without the whites, Rhodesia would not exist and South Africa would not exist. And then, out of the sense of fairness that white people have, you also supported blacks in the way that you thought was appropriate in those areas.
Yes, you make some good points. If I may again interrupt you, I apologize. Before I forget,
no, it's fine.
I also want to say about English and Afrikaans, that because of previous things in prior times with Cecil Rhodes and the Boer War and that kind of thing, that you had whites who, you know, you had Afrikaans whites in South Africa, the Boers, you had these English whites. And you also have a bunch of nitpicking between the two sides, where the English say, oh, the Boers are like this, the Afrikaners are like this, the Afrikaners say the English are like that. And you've got all kinds of silly nitpicking, let's say in the way that maybe the French and the English or might nitpick against each other. Oh, you know, this and that. And we let tiny things like that get in our way over things that are actually much more important, was we are Europeans. We have the same standards and values. Yes, you may speak a different language or have this thing slightly different than that, but all in all, we're the same people actually. And we let all kinds of shit get in our way. And there was even the kind of shit where the English in Rhodesia would say, oh, well, you know, yeah, here's a black Rhodesian. And you know what? I think I'd rather stick with a black Rhodesian than a white South African. And that's a bunch of shit, okay? Because there's a vast difference between a black Rhodesian and a white South African. Because with the white South African, you're looking at someone of your own kind, of your own race, related directly to you. So liberalism, all that liberal crap, you know, just messes with your head.
Right. Yeah. And again, there's hours that I could talk about, or that I could direct comments towards what you just said right there. But I will say this for kids of the website. When Jan is talking about liberalism, I use the term anti-whiteism, and I would refer to liberalism as a subset of anti-whiteism. And there's many different facets to anti-whiteism. That's just so for you. People that are used to my terminology are also used to your terminology. And I'll also say that I think Jan's making an important point here, in that there are major distinctions between the races. It doesn't mean that one is better or worse than another one, but if a state, and when Jan says state, he's talking about a country. So in the past, they were called states. They might be called nation states. They might be called countries, etc. When the state is formed, it's formed by a certain people and for a certain people. It's not necessarily formed for these other races, because they have different needs, they have different standards, they have different backgrounds. They're going to be able to either compete or not compete at the same level of the people who made the state. So they might need more, or they will demand some welfare, they'll demand handouts. Otherwise, if you bring them into your system where you have this economy, they're going to be, quote, poor. Now they're going to be poor because they're not competing the same as you. Where before, when they were just out in the wild before you came there, they weren't poor because they didn't have that concept of poor. But now they're poor, and now you have to give them things. So what I'm saying is, when you start taking these different races, it doesn't work out because they're different. It's like putting, I don't know, you know, crocodiles and penguins together, and you keep expecting them to act exactly the same and get along. You put them in the same little holding pen in the zoo. It's not going to work. And you can keep making all of these rules and restrictions that you keep putting on the crocodiles, but it's not going to work. And if it's too warm for the penguins, it's not going to work for the penguins either. Now, this is a crappy analogy, but I just came up with it out of my head. So what I'm trying to say is, what Jan is saying is, it's not just saying that whites are supreme and whites should have everything the way they want. The different people, when they make their own countries, they should be able to have it the way they want. When white people create a country, that's our house. That's for us. It's not okay for other people to come into our house and say, we have to change these things to fit these other people. Now, there are complex issues in that in some of the places, there were blacks on the outskirts of where whites built the nation, such as in South Africa. And then you have another layer of complexity where there was interaction between whites and blacks in the land that became Rhodesia. And this is something that we'll talk about when we get into more depth in depth with Rhodesia and the founding of Rhodesia, is how do you work all of this stuff out? What's right and what's wrong? Or is there even a right and wrong? But on the most basic level, what I want to get across is, you can't just have very disparate, very different people coming together with completely different needs and expect it to work out. It doesn't ever work that way. And if you throw white people to the wind, such as what the British government have done to the Rhodesians, that's extremely anti-white behavior towards those Rhodesians. Because, you know, they're doing the best they can. They have certain needs, and they have to be in charge of Rhodesia in order for Rhodesia to exist. If the blacks get in charge of Rhodesia, even if you don't change the name to Zimbabwe, it's not Rhodesia anymore. It's going to start falling apart, because if the blacks could have created a place like Rhodesia, they would have already done it. The countries of Western civilization only exist if Western kind is there to build them and maintain them. So that's a fundamental structure of reality that people need to understand. Okay, I went up on a tangent there.
It was very, very interesting. I will be quite brief. Thank you very much for translating the terminology. It's lovely to see. The key issue is communication. We must communicate accurately with people. So I love it. And I just want to say a very quick one is that when you introduce different kinds of peoples, different races and alien cultures, all that it brings you is more complexity. It brings you more complexity and more conflict. Whereas if you want to get rid of conflict, you bring as many people of a similar kind together. The notion that diversity somehow improves things is not true. It's the other way around. It's that the more similar people are, the more they get along and the less things they fight about. Because life is very complicated. And that is a primary lie that Americans and Western people are told these days. Final point, final quick one. The things that Rhodesians and South Africans and Portuguese and other Europeans lived through in Africa is basically we are doing in Africa what whites were doing in America and Canada 200 years ago. All that's changed is the technology. That's all. But we are modern day pioneers and modern day versions of what Americans and Canadians did, let's say 200 years ago.
Yep, good point. There's a lot of parallels. Well, Jan, do you want to stop this episode here and then we can pick up next time with the other questions that I had about the Civil War in Mozambique?
It's up to you. I'm quite happy to answer all the questions.
Okay, well, we'll keep going then.
Okay.
Okay, so we went off a bit of a tangent, but we'll get back, we'll pull it back online on course now. So my next question is referring to a video that Jan made about the Civil War in Mozambique. And this is after the collapse of the Portuguese government when Portugal threw their citizens in Africa under the bus. And the Portuguese had an exodus out of Angola, had an exodus out of Mozambique. And the government which took power in Mozambique was communist and anti-white. And the Rhodesians secretly trained a counter, or I don't know if you'd call it an insurgency force against the government to fight against them. So is there a way that you can give a brief detail on what RENAMO is?
Okay, basically what the whites did was the whites of Rhodesia did something that Russia has been doing, that even America does. I'm sure the British have also done it, is at a point in time, what you do is you've got one nation state and you actually train up people from another nation and you send them as a third force, as a insurgent group, as a guerrilla force to go and fight another state. The Cold War in recent decades is a perfect example of that. The Russians especially, along with the Chinese, were good at this. They basically trained up blacks and Asians and South Americans, and they created these groups and they used them as guerrillas to go and attack countries that were ruled by Western types. They basically set out to destroy the European empires. So you basically create an armed terrorist group and you assist them to go and fight another state using guerrilla techniques, because there aren't that many of them. So you use guerrilla techniques in order to wear them down and defeat them over time. And that's a particular type of warfare that the Russians especially perfected. Believe it or not, that may have come from the Anglo-Boer War, the Second Anglo-Boer War. The inspiration for that could actually originally have been the Boers. That's a whole other topic. I can show some of the logic behind that. But anyway, so Rhodesia basically found blacks that didn't like the communists, and the Rhodesians managed to talk to them, gather them together. They used radio to spread messages, etc. And they basically created an armed force of blacks that they helped to train and assist to go and overthrow the government of Mozambique.
Okay. And for the kids that are listening, it would make sense for Rhodesia to train this other force to fight against the government of Mozambique, because if I understand correctly, Jan, the government of Mozambique basically either explicitly or implicitly helped the terrorists that were coming across the border to attack Rhodesia. Is that right?
Exactly. They allowed an entire army of blacks called ZANLA. Then they allowed an entire army to relocate into Mozambique, and they let them build whatever camps they wanted, and they helped them. They helped them, and some of the Mozambique army even fought on the side of ZANLA. In fact, there were even some of them operating inside Rhodesia, and so effectively Mozambique had implicitly declared war on Rhodesia. I think they also explicitly closed the border. They probably came the closest of any black government to openly declaring war on Rhodesia. So okay, that was the Rhodesian response to it.
All right. So kids at home, what the Rhodesians were doing is they were creating a force that's called RENAMO that was fighting against the communist insurgents that were coming into Rhodesia to attack Rhodesia, and also fighting against, at the same time, the government of Mozambique, because the government of Mozambique was now the enemy of Rhodesia. And Rhodesians, for whatever reason, didn't want to get killed and blown up and have their country destroyed for whatever reason. How selfish of them. So they took the extra step to create this force that was inside of Mozambique. Now, a couple of questions about that. Did that create what they called the civil war in Mozambique that went on for 14 years or 17 years, something like that?
Yes. Basically, the result of this RENAMO activity did create a civil war between the blacks. And it was a civil war that continued to rage even after Rhodesia no longer existed. In fact, RENAMO exists to this day. It's not as powerful as it was. It's just a political party now, but it still exists all these decades later.
Okay. All right. Do you think that the CIA in any capacity was helping RENAMO?
There is some mention and some hinting that the CIA may well have assisted in helping RENAMO. I don't have many particular details, but from the data I've come across, there definitely were players outside of South Africa and Rhodesia who were also helping to fund RENAMO. So the Rhodesians created it and owned it. Later, the Rhodesians handed it over to the South Africans, but the Rhodesians were definitely liaising with other countries. We don't know exactly who, and it's very possible. One of the names that comes up is the CIA. I'm not 100% accurate on that, but I'd say there's maybe a 70% possibility that maybe the CIA did assist, maybe. If it wasn't the CIA, then it was some other nation that we don't know who it is.
Okay. Well, I have a question that's slightly correlated with that previous question. Let's hope so. I know that the United States was fighting against communism in Vietnam in the late 1960s and early 1970s, in just the same way that Rhodesia was also fighting against communist insurgents in their own country. But the United States did not support Rhodesia.
Yes.
Do you have? Yeah, so this might be a giant question that we can deal with in detail at a different time, but Do you have any opinion on why the United States was more than willing to go to the other side of the planet, invade someone else's country to fight against communism in Vietnam, but they would not help Rhodesians at all fight against communists invading their country?
Yes, that is a very interesting question. And Rhodesians themselves spoke about it when I was a kid. People used to say, oh, but look at the Americans, they're fighting in Vietnam. And look at the Viet Cong. The Viet Cong are being armed by the Russians. The Viet Cong are being given arms directly, mainly from Russia. And here are the Russians walking around in Africa. They're arming up all our enemies. The Russians were arming up the enemies of the Russians. The Russians were bigger players than the Chinese. The Russians and Chinese were working in Africa, but the Russians were the bigger players. And they were arming up the blacks. The Russians were arming up blacks in the Belgian Congo. They were arming up the blacks against the Portuguese. They were arming up the blacks against the South Africans. So, you know, here are the Russians running around arming all these different groups in Africa. And we look at America and we say, but hold on, you know, look at the American army. They're even fighting the same style of war in Vietnam. The Americans are fighting with helicopters. They've got to go hunting terrorists in the villages and stuff. And the American soldiers are trying to clean out the Viet Cong from the villages and things. Exactly the same tactics even, just on a bigger scale with more high tech. But we're looking at that, and there were also a couple of American Vietnam vets who actually ended up coming and fighting in Rhodesia. There's even one guy that was in the video, that video that I did about why white men have been losing wars since World War II. And I talk about Vietnam and Rhodesia, and in the Rhodesian film footage, you actually get an American talking, and there's an American fighting in Rhodesia, and he's the guy who says, killing them isn't the problem is finding them. And that American actually comes, and he's an ex-Vietnam vet. So yes, that is exactly correct. So the question is, you know, here are the Americans doing this, and they're going to all that trouble in Vietnam to do it in Vietnam, which is not, you know, on America's border. You know, so why doesn't America support us? That was a big question that all of the whites of Southern Africa asked, is that we're fighting the same enemy. We're fighting the same enemy. They're getting the same training and weapons. And you know what? You'll even see, if you go and you study more deeply, even in South Africa, The ruling party of South Africa even went, the guys who now rule South Africa, they even went to Vietnam in the 1990s. In the 1990s to go and ask the Vietnamese for advice on, you know, how did they fight the Americans, because the blacks in South Africa need to use this, to use the lessons from Vietnam to fight the whites. So, you know, all these things are so interlocked. It's the same enemy. The bottom line is really politics. Politics, again, is the bastard that messes everything up. And the real interesting question, and Brandt, I think this is a whole deep topic, even for Americans and for yourself, and I will try with the best sources that I've got to answer from what I can find in our documentation. But I will tell you that if I look at America and America's methods, after World War II, there was this whole issue of using the United Nations to form allies, okay? In the same way that there were all these allies, aka Jew-induced enemies of Germany, that you formed these alliances to go and smash whoever you didn't like, that after World War II, the Americans especially seemed to be enjoying this concept of allies. and that they saw the United Nations as a way of going and smashing everybody. And they decided to use it against the communists in Asia. The first place where they used it, the first, let's call it American-led United Nations alliance after World War II, was the war in Korea. The Korean War was a war, believe it or not, where even Rhodesians and especially South Africans, Australians, New Zealanders, British went to fight communism in Korea. So it was like, oh, we are the allies who defeated Hitler. Now we're going to defeat the communists in Korea. And that is the war that led to that stalemate and the division of Korea into North and South Korea. So everyone was into that and everyone dived in a World War II mode. When it came to Vietnam, it doesn't seem as if the Americans were able to pull the same thing off in Vietnam. But a place where they were able to pull a similar thing off was in the Congo, in the Belgian Congo, what is now Zaire. Well, I think the name is back to Congo again. But the big black country in the center of Africa at the equator. If you look in the early 1960s, that thing was done through American pressure using the United Nations. And they also brought in troops from Ireland, I think, and maybe even Sweden and India. So they tried a similar allied thing in the Congo. In the Congo, when they did it in the Congo, they were actually fighting on the side of the communists. America was leading it, and America was driving it. I have got a video on the Congo if you want to watch that, because you'll see that America is actually the driving force. And I don't think that went so well. And I think after the Congo, this whole idea of United Nations alliances, that seems to have started fading away. And you'll see that in all the other wars, it's been more a case of America decides they're going to do it. And then if somebody else wants to piggyback onto it, then yeah, they do it, e.g. Iraq and all that kind of stuff. But that concept of the alliances kind of faded away. And the other thing about America is that apart from that involvement in the Congo, America has sort of stayed away from Africa. And the more I've looked into it, the more I've concluded that America is afraid. As super strong as America is, I think that the white elite of America are afraid of meddling in Africa. And the reason I think this is so is that I think that black Americans have got too much political power in America, and those black Americans act on behalf of blacks in Africa, that blacks in Africa run to them, tell them tall tales about the whites, then the black Americans cause trouble for you guys in America. And the one place where I have recently found a proper quote on this is in Ian Smith, the Prime Minister of Rhodesia, in his memoirs called The Great Betrayal. In his memoirs, he actually talks about a time when he speaks to an American politician. He's talking to Americans. He's in direct contact. He visits America, and he's got Americans coming to Rhodesia, and he talks to them, and he's asking them about, you know, what can they do, etc., etc. And he actually quotes one of them. He quotes one who says that America doesn't want to get involved in the Rhodesian conflict, and I think in wars in Africa, because of the blacks in America. And if you want, I can find you the exact quote and the page and send you a screenshot of it so that you can see it. But I really think that your blacks in America actually scare your elite. Not because the blacks can overthrow you, but that the blacks see Africa from a completely different light, and they're going to be on the side of their brothers in Africa, and they will stir up trouble for you, riots and nonsense. And if you look even at America in the 1960s, at the same time that blacks were being stirred up by communists in Africa, there were blacks in America that were stirred up by communists in America. And there are quotes from them. There's even a video. If you haven't seen the video, just give me a shout. I'll give you the name of the video. I downloaded it the other day. Because all that stuff in America with the civil rights and all that kind of stuff, all of that, there was communism, and there were Jews involved in that as well. There were Jews that were also driving this thing. And there was violence in America. You know, there were times in the 60s when blacks were blowing up and managing to knock out the electricity in entire cities in the United States. And I think that the way that that your elite resolved the problem was to, you know, eventually give in and say, oh, okay, we'll have civil rights. We have civil rights. You can do this, you can do that. And, you know, hands off kind of a thing. Maybe just look a bit more closely into that. Maybe you've got thoughts on it. But I've actually seen stuff where those blacks are talking, and they're talking, and the evidence is there that they were communists. The same force that was working in Africa was working inside America.
That sounds entirely plausible to me. I hadn't thought of that angle before, where the government was already so anti-white that they wanted to continue to, you know, treat blacks with kid gloves inside the United States and let a white nation fall to blacks just so they could continue to virtue signal. I wanted to say virgin signal for some reason. That doesn't make any sense. To virtue signal and stay inside that anti-white United States, how the riots were responded to, and also the I can't remember. The commission, it was an all-white male commission, and they had come to the conclusion that the reason that blacks' economic performance was so low was due to white racism. It was not where all of that is integrated, where it meshes together, and that definitely could have been a decision to throw the white Rhodesians under the bus. So that's unfortunate, but those are the types of things that I'm glad that we're discussing. People need to know about this.
I've got of the thing because I downloaded it the other day. The video you must watch is a video called Anarchy USA 1966. It was created by the John Birch Society. Anarchy USA 1966. John Birch Society. You'll even find it on YouTube. I think I downloaded my copy from YouTube. If you have any problems with it, let me know. But it's an excellent thing. And it was done by a guy called Edward Griffin.
Oh, Edward Griffin.
Is that a name you know?
Yeah, it seems familiar. I might be incorrect here, but it seems like he's the author who wrote the book The Monster at Jekyll Island, or... whatever that title is, about the formation of the Federal Reserve.
And another discussion of it says, film on the Marxist roots of the civil rights and decolonial movement. So I think I looked at a couple of minutes of that video and I found it very interesting. It was very good. Raw film footage from the 1960s. And I must tell you that, you know what, I think that there's a lot of Jewish stuff that's all tied together, is that when you guys had all that violence, you also had the peace movements for not fighting in Vietnam. So you had all these Jews and things running around with all kinds of multicultural messages, and men mustn't fight in Vietnam, etc. That whole peace movement with the flowers and the drugs and all that kind of stuff. I must tell you that I think the 1960s is a very pivotal point for you Americans. That lots and lots of things went wrong for you whites in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. And that by the time the 60s ended, that we whites in Africa, we were still racist and we were still fighting on, but we'd lost you. We'd lost you. If our war had been earlier, like in the 1950s, I think your government might have had a different view. It's just a thought.
Right. Okay. So I got to cut in here for the listeners and the viewers. When Jan uses the word racist, it has a different connotation than when I'm talking about what that word means. So for myself or people within white well-being, we don't use the word racist because in general, that word is controlled by anti-whites and they put the meaning of the word into people's heads. Now there's going to be other people like Jan who doesn't mean it in the same way that the anti-whites mean it. He means it in the way of people being racist and putting the well-being of their people first and foremost, like all of the races on the planet do, except for white people. And whites in America had already turned from white well-being, taking care of their people, to taking care of everyone else except for whites, because we were told, we were brainwashed, that's the right thing to do. The Rhodesians and South Africans, they didn't get that brainwashing yet. Americans were on the forefront of that. And you're right, Jan, the 1960s was absolutely horrible. So besides the things that you talked about, it was also the Hart-Celler Immigration Act that was passed in 1965. I think it might have also, a similar one in 65 also happened in Australia that started opening up our countries to non-whites. So we started getting racially destroyed at that point legally. So it was a horrible time period.
Excellent for mentioning all that stuff. And I think that maybe just another short one is I'll say that it looks to me like Richard Nixon was one of your better presidents, maybe even the best president that you had in my lifetime, because I've seen lots and lots of quotes from Nixon where he talks about Jews and blacks and all kinds of things. And I remember the big outrage, you know, about Nixon hadn't done much. The whole removal of Nixon, I think, is another key element in destroying America, that you lost one of the last guys who was willing to say anything.
Yeah, you might be right. And since you brought up Nixon, I also have to say this. You know, people may not know this, but Nixon recorded a lot of his private meetings for whatever reason. It was like he was keeping an audio diary. So we have a lot of evidence, or we have audio of what was going on during that time. And he had a conversation with someone, and I don't remember who it was, and they were discussing the problem with the Jewish influence, the anti-white Jewish influence inside the United States. And Nixon said, "Do you think this is a problem, Bob," or whatever his name was? And he says, yeah, Mr. President, I do. And he says, "Yeah, boy, so do I." So Nixon knew that was a problem, but he didn't do anything about it. He did nothing. And this is something that I want to point out that is extremely important for the well-being of whites, is that our leaders have been constantly cowards. And what they've done is they've decided to take a course of action that's good for their political career or good for their political party, or they want to stay in power. So instead of standing up for us, instead of them standing up for the citizens, for the people that put them in power, they let this stuff slide, because they don't want to get any friction. So even though you're right, Jan, in that Nixon understood these things, he still didn't take the action necessary to correct our course. none of our presidents have since World War II. They've just let everything just continue to be derailed and become more anti-white. And we just become more and more deluged with people that are not of our biospirit, people that are not of European stock. And our countries are just slowly getting destroyed and getting turned over to these, you know, these outsiders.
No, excellently said. I understand what you're saying. We don't have Hitlers. We don't have people that really stand up. All of our, you know, the West, a word that comes across a lot is the West is very feeble. We act as if, oh God, no, you know, everyone in the West, there's nobody in the West who can stand up and actually talk about race openly. Probably the last leader who did it was Hitler, probably, on the world stage.
Yeah, yep, I could see that. Okay, well, I've got one more small question, which is related to our original topic of this civil war in Mozambique. And what I understand is that this insurgency force that the Rhodesians had created, called RENAMO, they were helping out and controlling RENAMO, and then later on they had to leave control of that and deny that they had even built RENAMO, and let the South Africans start helping out and controlling RENAMO, because the British government, who in my estimation are anti-white, they came down and they were doing inspections of Rhodesia and the election process as the country was getting turned over to blacks. And they were also trying to figure out, you know, who had created RENAMO. So anyway, RENAMO was still going. It was strong. And then at some point, the new government, the black government of what is now Zimbabwe instead of Rhodesia, they decided to get into the fight along with a couple of other countries. And so you had now four countries all fighting against RENAMO. And my question about the Rhodesian Air Force and Army is, were there still whites in the military at that point in time?
That's a very good question. The first problem is, yes, we gave the blacks the full army and the air force. As time went by, the whites were driven out of the air force. There is another event that happened, is that after Rhodesia collapsed and two-thirds of the whites, including myself and my family, pulled out of Rhodesia within 5 years. We looked at this and we said, no way are we living here under this guy's rule. We're out of here. And most of us came to South Africa, including lots of English. And there were quite a lot of Rhodesian soldiers who joined the South African army. And what I've never discussed is that the South Africans and the ex-Rhodesians actually engaged in a very quiet little war inside Zimbabwe in about the early to mid 1980s. Part of that war, I'm going to go back to that little war because there's one particular aspect of it that's absolutely fascinating. One of the things that happened just a couple of years after the whites had lost power is that suddenly one night somebody came and blew up a bunch of the aircraft of the Zimbabwean Air Force. Yeah. And among the people that were arrested, they arrested South Africans. There was a South African that was arrested inside Zimbabwe, etc. But from what I've been able to understand, because it's a secret, it's more or less a secret to this day, but from what I can piece together from the military stuff, is that the ex-Rhodesians and the South Africans mounted that operation against Mugabe's people and they blew up a bunch of aircraft. So if you want more details on that, we can discuss that. But there's an even more fascinating thing that they did. They did almost a kind of RENAMO type thing. That is fascinating. So all of those kinds of things went on in the 1980s. And again, it shows you that there was life after Rhodesia. And if the whites had all just stuck together, there could have been more life after Rhodesia. But okay, to answer your question, I've told you that for a specific reason, because you're asking how many whites were still fighting in the Zimbabwe army. Mm-hmm. Lots of the whites left, but there were some whites who stayed. There were some whites who stayed on for more than 10 years, and they even became very buddy-buddy with the blacks, the government. And even the other day, another Rhodesian told me that he knew a guy, and I think an Afrikaans guy even, who was born in Rhodesia towards the end of Rhodesia, grew up in the time of Zimbabwe, and he joined the Zimbabwe Air Force as a helicopter pilot, and he fought for Mugabe. But what I do know is that after there was this, the explosion, after the explosion, the blacks realized that there's a white thing going on, and the blacks were quite quick in starting to get rid of white pilots and officers out of the Zimbabwe Air Force. I think they got rid of most of them over a period of about 2 years. So that there was something of a purge that came after that. So yes, there were still a couple of whites here and there in various places, perhaps in the army and the Air Force, but the Air Force especially was purged. And so that'll give you an idea. There was still that little bit of liberal, a couple of liberal dribs and drabs that still existed. And so the Zimbabwean army and Air Force was still probably the highest quality army and air force of any black state in Africa. Also because the blacks themselves had been fighting against the whites for years, and they were, you know, sort of still in the mode and still pretty good. So that they'd learned a lot from the fighting. So if that gives you a bit of a background to that.
Yes, it does. Thank you. All right. Well, that concludes all of the questions that I had.
I think there's one that I haven't answered. You asked if they were switched out, was the military just as effective as it was white? The answer is no, it was not as effective as the white military, but it was much better than the pure black militaries. And the other one that you have is, if they weren't switched out, how did whites feel fighting for their own enemies? Yeah. That is a very good question. That brings us back to the liberal white mindset. The whites who stayed behind and who were now, quotes, white Zimbabweans, they even called themselves white Zimbabweans, they were now patriotic to this black country. And there were quite a few of them who were patriotic until the late 1990s, when the whole freaking thing started falling apart and Mugabe started going after everyone. So yes, in that time, they were still liberal and believing in this Zimbabwe rubbish. Yes, they were fooled. And they were like, no, we live in, it used to be called Rhodesia, we live in Zimbabwe now, and we are patriotic to this country that we're in. And later they get shafted by the blacks.
I'm glad that you brought that up, because that's extremely relevant to what I see happening across all of our countries right now. And of course, what I'm most familiar with is what I see inside the United States, where these whites are inside this anti-white narrative that says that whites stole everything from everyone else, and we're evil, and we don't have any value, so it's okay to attack whites and kill whites and take money away from whites and deny them jobs and deny them access to universities, you give preferential treatment to all these non-whites, flood non-white countries flood white countries. I'm speaking too fast here. And so, when, again, to kids listening, when Jan says liberal, what he's talking about is the anti-whites. So the biggest problem that we have, it's not anti-whites from all these different races, it's the anti-whites inside of our own race. It's our anti-white brothers and sisters that cause the biggest problems, because we're not all on the same side. We're not pulling in the same direction. And also, if you notice what Jan said, they were fine with being patriotic towards Zimbabwe until the ruler of Zimbabwe, Mugabe, started coming down on all the whites. And sometimes these people are so brainwashed and so stupid that they never even see the danger, and they get killed. They get murdered. They get replaced one way or another. And at no point do they stand up and say, you know what? Actually, we were wrong. Sorry. Sorry, all you other white people that I screwed over and called you a racist and didn't help you out at all. And I was kind of cowardly and brainwashed, and I was chummy-chummy with blacks. It's okay to be chummy-chummy with blacks or anyone else, but within a larger context, of when your own people are getting attacked, it's ridiculous to take the cowardly approach, take the easy approach, the virtue signaling approach, and say, well, I'm a better white person than you because I'm going to be anti-white. I'm not going to stand up for my own people. My identity isn't white. My identity is just something else over here. It's this country. Or my identity is I'm a fan of this sports ball team. Or I like to dress up for a superhero and go to comic conventions or some just ridiculous crap. So one of the things that I hope people are getting from the discussions that Jan and I have is that as our people, especially our men, have moved further away from being masculine, from taking action, from demanding that they have power, it weakens all of us. It weakens our people's collective resolve. And we are attacked on individual levels, and we are attacked as entire societies and as entire states, because so many of our own people are so weak and so brainwashed, and they will not stand with us. Well, I think we're going to go through a certain period of time where there's going to be less and less of these weak white people, because for whatever reason, they're not going to make it through this bottleneck that we're running through now. They're either not going to procreate because they think that there's too many white kids, so they're not going to have white kids. Some of them are actually murdered as they interact with blacks and other non-whites because they don't see the danger, and they're paying the price of that. So I don't know. Jan, did you want to say anything about what I rambled about there?
Most definitely. Most definitely. I just made some notes because I want to touch on some things. What is the name of that cartoonist that recently came out and went and started talking about the blacks? And I saw his latest video where he says, whites must stay away from blacks. What's his name again?
Oh, Scott Adams.
Yes, 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 yes. Okay, that's beautiful. Because you're saying some very important things here. So what I just want to add to what you've said is that you talk about the fact that whites don't see the danger. That is a very, very accurate thing. With all this Jewish liberal anti-whitism, I'm going to try and use a bit of your terminology, with that kind of approach, they come at you with a bunch of morality and just basically a bunch of assorted junk arguments, okay, that sound like they make sense, okay, that and they put you to sleep. And they put you at ease, and they tell you, "Oh no, no! You see, if you work with the blacks, the reason the blacks are against you is because you treated them wrong." So the Jews are coming, and they actually tell you, at the end of the day, it always turns out to be the fault of the white person, even when it's not, and even when it never was. It's always right. The fault of the white person. So I must tell you that this horrifies me when I see some of the bullshit, because it's just pure bullshit that these Jews and liberals and also Oprah types, etc., pass on to you Americans, and the things they say about Africa, including apartheid, And they say, oh no, you see, the reason the whites of South Africa had all these problems with the blacks was because they were so freaking racist. If you weren't racist to the blacks would be nice. And then the whites are like, oh no, no, shit, we did it wrong, okay? And total hogwash, okay? It's total crap. And I find myself constantly wanting to come back and say, hold on, you got to watch out for that argument. Watch out for that piece of bullshit. You know, they're coming up with new crap, okay? And it's very dangerous. And it's amazing that whites in Rhodesia and even whites in South Africa were fooled into becoming blind to the danger of blacks. But mm-hmm. but in the case of the Rhodesians, it's the group that remained behind. And I'll tell you, liberalism lasted for about 20 years. Then another thing that you pointed out is you said that the anti-whites, talking about anti-white whites, mm-hmm. that the anti-white whites hurt the whites more than the non-whites hurt the whites. That is so deep and so accurate. I cannot stress it enough. The Jews must be laughing their asses off at yeah. how they are able to use whites to destroy other whites, and that the ability of whites to destroy other whites is greater than the ability of Jews and blacks together to destroy whites. And then when other whites destroy whites, then the whites who are left become more and more scared, and they're like, oh God, we don't stand a chance. Meanwhile, the people that are really screwing you over and hurting you the most are your own kind. And if you didn't have, and if I may just say my definition of this is my definition of a liberal mm-hmm. slash anti-white. My definition of a liberal anti-white, okay, based on what I've seen in South Africa and looking around carefully, I've concluded that those people are A, cowards, B, stupid. They are nothing more than stupid cowards. Okay, so you got some whites. You basically got white pussies who are easy to scare, and they panic their asses off, and they immediately join the other side. In fact, Scott Adams actually admits it. At least he's honest. I'm not against Scott Adams. I am thankful that he comes and says it out of his own mouth. He actually said in his video, I'll actually add it in when I do this thing. He actually says that that he wanted to be on the winning side. And so he was on the winning, he saw the blacks as the winning side, and he said that he even identified as black. I'm actually grateful for his honesty, that he just comes out and talks and says his thing. And I wish we could get more liberals who could confess. There was a girl as well. There was one girl that made a short video on Gab at one point where she said, oh, the stupid things I used to say when I was a liberal. And I can't remember what she mentioned. She mentioned one of the things that she said, and she said, oh boy, there's a lot more to come. And unfortunately, I never saw any more videos from her. I would love to just have those whites who were fooled liberals just come out and just say it. Cause I'm not going to say we must hang them or do anything to them. I just want people to see out of their own mouths and minds how they were fooled. And I'm so happy, and I'm happier with the fact that they came right, that I'm willing to forgive everything. If they came right, that's fine. That's all good and fine. They're our brothers and sisters, and they were fooled. They were fooled by something that they didn't realize. But it is, and that is the danger, returning to anti-whites harming whites. That's the truth. And the biggest danger you face in your country are the anti-white whites who are smashing you. And you'll find that when all is said and done, that if you've got hordes and hordes of non-whites with their Jews, that you'll be able to take care of them. Your biggest problem are the anti-whites. They're hurting you the most. They're the ones that are smashing you. And they're the ones that are fighting people like Trump, etc. And the final thing I'll say is that what I call liberalism, which you call anti-whitism, it's a scam. And from the Jewish perspective, Jews must be always working to keep the scam alive. But it is a scam and it doesn't last long. So the good news is it doesn't last long. It'll probably last 20 or 30 years and then it'll die a natural death. But it's very unpleasant and it harms whites a lot.
All right, Jan, we have covered the questions that I wanted to go over, which was referring to the Rhodesians starting the Renamo counterinsurgency in Mozambique. The civil war went on for 14 to 17 years. Rhodesia, in that meantime, was fighting against communism in their country, even though the United States was fighting against communism. Likewise, they refused to help Rhodesia. And you went over the reasons why that might have been. And then we discussed all of these different anti-white policies that started becoming enacted in the 1960s in several of our countries. And also, we quickly discussed the turnover of the military to Zimbabwe from what was Rhodesia, and the whites were replaced by black troops and black pilots. Some of the anti-white whites, you know, liberals, they still, you know, hung on to those positions, and they were patriotic. They were loyal to the new black government, even though it was anti-white. And then over time, they started to get replaced as well as Robert Mugabe, the leader of Zimbabwe, started to crack down even more on the whites that were still left in Zimbabwe. And that covers everything then. And I just did a little, recap. Is there any closing comments that you want to make before we finish today?
No, there's nothing really to say. I think the liberalism and the anti-white whites, that is one of the most important issues. That is the most important issue for you people in America and Europe. That's your biggest danger currently. So you mustn't worry about the non-whites destroying you. It's the anti-white whites that are harming you the most. And they are the ones, they and the Jews are the ones that are hitting you the most and doing the most harm to you. So, for us, we're sort of coming out the other side where we're going to be facing off against the blacks, but that we're in a different space to you. And I think the sooner you can try and kill what I call liberalism, the sooner you can kill that, the better for you. That will be the key to your turnaround. But by no means are you defeated yet.
Oh, no. Yeah, I agree totally. Yeah, the whites everywhere are going to win eventually. It just depends upon how much damage there's going to be in the interim and how long is it going to take. And as you're talking about taking care of the anti-white whites, I do that, and my community does that through white well-being, which refers to taking care of ourselves first and foremost, and not allowing any anti-white attacks of any kind upon us. And we seek to unbrainwash the brainwashed whites who have decided to hate themselves and hate the rest of the white race. So step by step, we're getting there. Everything's going to be good. Everything's good. No problem, guys. Thumbs up. And I'm done. Thanks for listening, everyone.
And you know what, while you were winding up, I had one final thought. I saw on social media the other day on the phones, on one of the white groups, I saw some white person there saying to another white, saying, "Oh, why are you so proud of being white?" And so I quickly wrote a little note, and my note said, if you aren't proud to be white, it's because you don't know anything about history. And that is my final comment.
That's a good comeback. That is a valid comeback.
If you don't see the end, if you don't see the top, don't stop. We know you'll win. Every fight you'll fight, every game you play, you will reach the top. At the top, that is where you will stay.